Talk given Friday, 15th October, 1976. Let us consider together very intently the true meaning and significance of meditation. We start off with the fundamental fact of energy. You may call it transcendence, you may call it God. You may give it any name you please, ultimate reality. But it is convenient in our day and age to use the word energy. We, being what we are, constituted as we are, naturally split up what we perceive and experience and understand of this energy into several compartments. We use terms like secular and religious. The spiritual world, matter, spirit, and so on, and mind, and all the rest of it. And we tend, in fact, we can almost never do otherwise. We always break up this one total reality into several fragments. We cannot be conscious and function in terms of totality. And it is this tendency to, unavoidable tendency to divide things up, which makes for the fragmentariness of our life and lies at the root of all our difficulties, our state of sorrow, and our state, to use a Catholic word, a Christian word, sin, meaning the sundered state, the broken up state. That is its fundamental meaning. Now, we are like that. But dormant within us are transcendent faculties of the mind. It is these which one may think which have to emerge and function in mankind, and then only we shall be fully human beings. This aspect of energy, which is what we, you and I, will call transcendence or something like that, it lies dormant within us. And transcendence functions within us when all the obstructions in us to transcendence are removed. When this takes place, then there is true meditation. It is not something which can be deliberately achieved or attained. It is not something which is merely given gratis. That is a partial view of what we call grace. We are like a piece of apparatus. If the apparatus is well tuned, well constructed, in good condition, then this transcendent something can manifest itself through the apparatus. Now there are certain simple factors which we must take into account. The organism, oneself, we commonly call a psychophysical organism. We might, if you like, also call it a spiritual psychophysical organism. For convenience in talking, we may talk of body and psyche, and mind, using mind in a transcendent sense, not in the ordinary sense in which the world uses the word mind, namely as just a collection of passing mental processes, mental emotional processes, not merely as that, but mind in its transcendence. Mind as this energy, this one total reality, whatever you like to call it, that aspect of this energy which interacting with the another aspect of energy which we call matter, the body, they are all fundamentally one and the same thing. This aspect which we name mind, universal mind, interacting with body, which is one manifestation of universal matter, the human body, gives rise to psyche. And psyche is rooted in each individual's brain and nerves and the functioning of his ductless glands and so forth. Therefore, it is very decidedly your psyche, my psyche, his psyche, and so forth. We must really be able to appreciate all these different aspects in themselves and in their integration, which we call the living being, the man. Now, the brain is the recorder, the synthesizer, the classifier, the categorizer of all the sensations that come to it through the functioning of the sense organs. This means that the brain is being continuously conditioned by what comes to it. Bear that in mind. It is continuously conditioned. And the nature of this conditioning is, as you will see, therefore, intimately linked up with the nature of one's psychical functioning. Psychical functioning. Now, psyche is the link between brain, the physical brain as such, and pure mind. You may, if you like, use the word soul or spirit, depending upon what sort of word you like to use. They're all the same in actuality. The psyche is the link between brain and mind, and brain in its turn is the link between psyche and mind. The particular faculty which plays perhaps the dominant part in our functioning as psychophysical organisms is our faculty of speech. A system of symbolical sounds. Which represent our concepts and which is used by one person to communicate his ideas and experiences and his perceptions to others around him. Bear this very carefully in mind. Again, difficulty of language. I say in mind, but it's only the brain and the psyche, our own particular psyche, which receives this impress. Bearing this in mind, you will see that whilst brain and psyche are linked with pure mind in its actuality is something quite transcendent to our whole brain-psyche functioning. Our speech-thought functioning. Now, it is this pure mind, this universal something which is quite transcendent over and above all that we experience, think, feel, see, perceive, hear, touch, and so on. It is this which is like a seed, I'm just talking metaphorically for the moment, which is like a seed planted in the soil of the brain itself. All the great religions of the world, all the great spiritual teachings, whether they are presented in superbly psychological forms or metaphysical forms or aesthetic forms, they all indicate this. It is like a seed which has been dropped, a transcendent seed which has been dropped into the soil of the brain as such. Now, if this soil is really healthy, pure, there will be the right nutriment for that seed of transcendent mind to come to full flower through that organism. But, as we know, our conditioning ties us up in knots all the time. And all the functioning of our senses, of our psyche, of our brain, and the use of our faculty of speech, and all the logical structures we can build up through speech and so forth, all the knowledge and experience, ideas, beliefs, and so on, they are all bedeviled by our natural drives which have received a particular shape through the influence of our socio-cultural heritage. The fundamental drives are for food and sex. Food in order that the individual organism may survive, sex in order that the species may survive. And every single culture, I am talking of social groups, every single social group has its own particular do's and don'ts and the right way to set about food and sex and so forth. So you see, all this makes us use our senses, our seeing, our hearing, our touching, our tasting, our psychical processes of feeling and thinking, as we call it, which is only just silent talking. Thinking is only silent talking, you see. Makes us use all of them in a manner which prevents the manifestation of pure mind. Now remember, pure mind is total, it's universal. It prevents totality. The brain and the psyche prevent us from functioning totally. They are constantly clamoring for satisfaction. Brain and psyche, all our desires, all our thoughts, our feelings, our ambitions, our drives, and so forth. So, this aspect of the transcendent, which is nevertheless in us, in the system of Kundalini Yoga, for instance, they say that Shiva's home is here, in the brain. In the Judaic system, they say that Neshama, the essence of Yahweh himself, is implanted in the organism. That is, Ruah, the intellectual soul, as it is called, Plato's Nous, Intellectus of Aristotle, and so forth, and Nefesh, the animal soul, you see. These are subsidiaries. But you'll see that all the great teachings of the past have this element in them. And modern teachings also do have the same element, including Krishnamurti's teachings. Only the form in which he presents it is absolutely modern. He does not use any of the old-fashioned words, but his entire presentation is basically, fundamentally, the same presentation. This you'll find especially in his latest book, the Notebook, which has been published this year. Very good. Now, the mind in its totality contains the brain and psyche. The brain is a part. The mind is the whole, and this part, which is conditioned, in any case, cannot contain the whole, and does not allow the whole to function. We have to sort of feel this and follow it very quietly and intently. Otherwise, somehow, it will just remain so many words, perhaps a logical structure which pleases our intellectual faculty and no more. But for it to be practical, we have to break through this barrier that the brain and the psyche present to us. Now, total perception lies in the field of the mind, not of the brain. The brain is incapable of seeing the whole of life. How then can you or I see life in its wholeness? This is our problem, actually. Now the brain seizes hold of everything that comes to it. And the psyche reacts by saying, I like this, I don't like it. So there is attachment, there is aversion at play. We live enclosed within ambivalence. Therefore the whole is never seen, never heard, never felt, cannot be thought. Thought is a divider. And thought keeps you tied back to what is already known. You can't think of the unknown. When the unknown comes within the purview of conscious realization, then at last you can say something about it. And we call that a thought. All right. But now, when the brain is receiving these impressions all the time, it remains in a state of negation, a state of denial. What does it deny? What does it negate? The state of negation means a state of freedom from reactivity. Just a pure observation. With the brain making no reply to the impressions that come to it. This is the crux of the whole matter. This is the whole secret. The brain does not say yea or nay to it. Because whatsoever impression comes is a passing thing. If the brain likes it and holds on to it, it is acquiring something. If the brain brings its values and judgments to bear upon it, these are conditioned values, conditioned judgments. They're always partial. They're always distorted. If the brain does that, then the wholeness is missing. Not only is the wholeness missing, but the brain is cluttering itself up with a collection of ideas, beliefs, knowledge, and so forth. Thereby, it becomes less and less efficient as an instrument for seeing the fact as the fact. This is a very difficult matter. We have to be very, we have to take ourselves to task to the nth possible degree where this is concerned. We do not see a fact as a fact. We see it colored by our conditioning, our preconceptions, our assumptions, our beliefs, our ideas, and above all, our desires. We see the world as we would like to see it, not the truth of it. So you see, the brain has to cease interfering with the seeing of the fact as the fact through the interposition of its particular values, its particular judgments, its likes and dislikes and so forth. And this is the meaning of the brain being in a state of denial, of negation. It does not allow these to interfere. Just let the brain be quiet, an instrument of observation. It's a very, very difficult and an extremely arduous task. But this is the true yoga, the true restoration of the fragment to the whole, which can only be done in terms of mind. The body cannot be restored to unity with the whole cosmic body. That is impossible. Otherwise, the very meaning of the word body would be just nonsensical. See? This restoration of the fragment to the whole. Now, when the brain is like this, it ceases to interfere with the activity of the mind, the pure mind, the neshama of the Kabbalist, Shiva residing in his abode up here of the yogi, the Christ consciousness of the Christian mystic, the Buddha nature of the Buddhist. Then all that can function through this person whose brain is pure, it's emptied. That doesn't mean you haven't thoughts or ideas. Thoughts will, of course, run through your mind. Ideas will, of course, arise. They are the continuously changing living process of the individual man, of the person, the living person. But to hold on to them or to regard them as truth is the error. There comes the time when the brain just remains purely, absolutely still and quiet. And then it sees in, then through this brain, this transcendent aspect of mind functions. Now, when this transcendent aspect of mind functions, this is true meditation. Because the transcendent aspect of mind is not your mind or my mind or anybody's mind. Through you, the living psychophysical person in the world, is manifested a transcendent phenomenon. That's a strange sentence, a transcendent phenomenon. Because here we are using the word transcendence as being synonymous with the total reality. But a phenomenon means something which is separate, and this is where language begins to become very, very difficult and easily misleading. So you must be aware of that. But I have to use it. You'll know what I'm driving at. This something which is universal, which is beyond all grasping, which cannot be characterized, which has no characteristics we can talk about, this begins to function through the individual. When the individual does talk about it or record his experience, you can read the writings of all the mystics, the greatest of the metaphysicians too, you'll find this sort of thing coming out. Plato has an enormous amount about it. When this happens, then you are fully human, and you are in the condition of meditation. It is not you who are meditating, but transcendence is functioning through you, the prepared instrument, the unresisting instrument. And this is the true meaning of meditation. You can't attain it by striving for it. You can strive only for that which you can preconceive, or what you have already known. But this is not a thing which lies within the sphere of knowledge, the accumulated, acquired knowledge. It is the actual process of knowing. Knowing by being it. You are it. That's one of the reasons why Eckhart, though he didn't say it in this context, but it is one of the reasons why Eckhart said, "For man verily is God, and God verily is man." I mean, this is true. For a Catholic living at the time when fire was rather close to one, if one said certain things, you see, was an extraordinary thing. So you see how every element of selfness is out of the situation altogether. Every element of selfness, no ideals, no passion to serve the Lord or further the purposes of the Most High or anything like that can play its part. Because the moment something like that is present, clogging the brain, the particular self, the power for self-enclosing is at work, and it prevents the totality from functioning freely through you. But when you talk about it, you can only use words which are used in the limited sphere. We use words like love, wisdom, goodness, truth, humility, innocence, purity, immensity, transcendence, total reality. We use words like that. But the moment we use words like that and you hear them with the brain, and you can't hear them otherwise, apart from the brain hearing, the brain has to take the dictionary meanings. Immediately the dictionary meanings come up. You see the difficulty of this. I am saying this because it is so important to steer clear of so much trash that goes about in the world under the name of meditation, whether transcendental or any other type, whatever it is. So much that goes about in the name of yoga, which is not yoga really. You see, so long as we understand that which it is not, to that extent we are clean. When we know the whole of the not in its fullness, all this is not, then I am truly silent and speechless, and that is unhindered and here. This is so difficult even to talk about, and infinitely more difficult to live. This emptying of the mind, of the brain, in order that mind, and do remember, we have to, for our purposes here, use the word mind in its transcendent sense, not in the dictionary sense. It's so difficult to live up to it. When the brain is really quiet, still and silent, you'll be conscious of yourself, you know you're awake. When the brain is still and quiet, completely silent, then the mind is completely awake. Those of you who are deeply concerned with Buddhism and Buddhist teaching, you know that the Buddha was called the fully awakened one. This is the meaning of awakening. That other something is in full charge. Not the I consciousness, the self consciousness, which separates out me as the subject from all the rest, which is the object. When the mind functions, the transcendent mind functions through you, then the reality of love and wisdom in their transcendence functions through you at the same time. They are associated with this pulse of creation, which we have talked of in previous meetings. With this pulse of creation, which is life-death functioning simultaneously. The transmutation process is the creation process. True creation is a transmutation of that which is into the very next. It is not procreation, which is being true to type. That which is transmuted is quite new. We have it even in modern science in its particular form. When one metal is transmuted into another, the number of protons and electrons in the atoms of the other element are different from the previous element, and the properties of this element are quite different from the properties of the other element. The analogy is helpful, but it doesn't go to the fullest extent. Where transcendent creation is concerned, it is utterly and absolutely new all the time. Therefore, what we commonly call destruction, death, are all involved in it. And this is one of the most terrible things to face. When, for instance, the great mystics have talked of the crossing of the abyss, they have talked about fear, which suddenly seizes you, and so forth. All this is associated with it. All our worldly values, anything to hold on to, is completely gone. And so, whilst we are alive, fully awake, most alive, we know death in its completeness, in its absoluteness, simultaneously. when this state takes place. Now the question will arise, well, if all this is so, what does one do in order that the brain may become free of all this thought, feeling, content? Question which will always be asked. There is an answer to that. This is exactly what none of us do. Every thought, every feeling which arises, every reaction which springs out of the brain because of the impressions that have come to it, follow that to its complete ending. That is the instruction, the one and only instruction as regards the technique. There is no other. The whole process of purification, you can't build up virtues like you collect all sorts of beautiful clothes in your wardrobe and use them for different occasions. You can't do it that way. You follow this right to its very end. A thought arises. All right. Pay attention to it. Follow it. You'll go on from thought to thought. Your mind will begin to wander. And then you'll say, oh no, I must bring it back to the original. Don't. Follow it as it goes. Follow it, pursue it. The same with the feeling. The young, the adolescent, and the not so young and not so adolescent have the enormous problem of sexual passion and so forth. Follow that. Just watch it. Like a bulldog who has got hold of something. Don't let it go. Don't indulge it. Don't resist it. Go with it. In your own psychical activity. Go right through with it. You see? And see what happens. There will come the time when that thought energy, that feeling energy, will come to rest. It will become calm. That doesn't mean it will become stagnant or static. It means that this disordered, confused turmoil will have disappeared, and that energy will vibrate in perfect harmony, in tune with the rhythmic pulse of the universe. And then what will happen, you will ask? Well, supposing I do that, and supposing I can do it, then what will happen? Then for the first time you will understand that thought and understand that feeling. This is the important thing. It is this understanding which utterly purifies the brain. Now the nature of this understanding is not of the type which we usually think of as understanding. I know about it now. I've got a nice logical structure in my mind, logical intellectual structure. This is the explanation, and this is what it is. You can go on having explanations which are beautiful, perfect logical structures for the next 20,000 million years, and you will be just where you were, square one. Nowhere else. That is not understanding. This extraordinary thing, understanding, is a is a thing whose inner characteristic is a state of unknowing. It is a state of unknowing. Unknowing as something external to you. I, the subject, know this. I, the subject, do not know this yet. But this unknowing, this state of unknowing, is the state of pristine purity of mind itself, something which cannot be put into words. And when that understanding is present, you will ask, well, is there any sign for that sort of understanding? Yes, there are signs. You will find that your action in relation to the thing you have understood is always natural, spontaneous. It will be essentially right. Essentially right. The world may not think it right. The world may say, oh, this is horrible, this is cruel, this is... Or the world may say the opposite, tied up in ambivalence, in its ambivalent values. But it will be essentially right in that passing moment, in that changing moment. These are very difficult things to enter into, even to begin to glimpse truly. That is one of the signs. Your action will be spontaneous, natural, and essentially right. And there'll be another sign, at least one other sign. If there is real understanding, there will always be the state of perfect compassion within yourself, and perfect peace. The compassion which is not an emotional expression of pity or anything like that, but the compassion, what we in India call the Mahakaruna, the compassion which is beyond all description. Your theist may put it in terms like this: the love which God has for man is such that he may burn up a man. Not very pleasant, is it? Call that a compassionate act? But follow the idea, follow the thought, brood on it. It can happen that way. It can happen the very reverse way. This state of compassion is indescribable. It is the thing which has gone beyond. We have said that about wisdom, the wisdom which has gone beyond. But it's the same with compassion. It's the same with purity or goodness. When we say purity, we associate it with respectability. We associate it with being unstained by vice and all the rest of it. That is also true, but it is a very limited truth put in that form. If purity meant that and that alone, how was it that when Mary Magdalene went to see Jesus, was the complete and sudden transformation, a transmutation in the presence of the embodied transcendence? What is this power? This is the power of meditation. This is the power of the samadhi, the supreme togetherness. When pure mind functions through brain and psyche in this manner, now do realize this, that where all this is concerned, we are right in the deepest depths of what the word religion means. Religious living, meditation in this supreme sense, in this true sense, has nothing to do with curing us of our ills. Don't imagine that my health will be better, my circumstances will improve, my own mind will be at peace and my heart will be calm. No, my own mind could be like the gales we had yesterday here. And my own heart can be torn to shreds with the tragedy around me or in me. All this can happen also. People seek religion exactly as they seek a comfortable bank balance or a more than comfortable bank balance or pleasure or go to the pub or anything else. It is just like that, only on a very ho-ho plane. Do beware of that. But if there is the beginning of perception, true perception, which is formless, shapeless, then it is true perception, because you are enabled to act rightly, inevitably, through that inner perceiving which has no shape or form. There's the beginning of true perception, you will see that to live religiously does not mean to solve your domestic problems or anything like that. They may get solved. Your circumstance may change into a shape which is more pleasant to deal with, to deal with psychophysically. But that has not brought you, the psychophysical organism, to the realization of the purpose of its existence, to be the living vehicle for transcendence to function. And also remember, you cannot pursue that as an ideal to achieve. The moment I pursue anything, it is myself who is at the center of his considerations. That has to go out. Then this transcendent dimension of mind can function. This is the true state of meditation, and it just comes, it just emerges like that. There were terrific gales and so on yesterday, and it was wet and stormy and so on. In the morning today, there was a brilliant sun, lovely sunrise. It just came along like that, also disappeared. That is the way of life, the way of transcendence. That is what we are concerned with, well and good. If that is not what we are concerned with, then we shall remain confined to brain and psyche and our natural drives and all the rest of it, and there'll be endless sorrow. Whatever we do, sorrow through pleasure, sorrow through pain. Both. Anxiety, fear, frustration, everything. Living the religious life does not mean that my anxieties will disappear. or should disappear. Not at all. They may disappear. In actual fact, anxieties and fears do disappear. Where is the soil in which anxiety and fear flourish? Where is the soil in which evil flourishes? In this conditioned brain, the soil for transcendent mind is full of evil bacteria which destroy the seed of mind. So, follow your thought, your feeling. Each of us has to do that all the time. It's a ceaseless task. It cannot end because it's like the living body. The bloodstream has to flow on, the lungs have to function, the heart has to function ceaselessly, day and night. It gets no payment. None of these things get any payment for it, for any of this, leave alone overtime. You can't demand anything from life. Life owes you nothing whatsoever. If we really understand these things, begin to understand them even, society will be quite different before very long.